Next is a morning meeting with disciples on July 9th, 1996 at Rodendaeche, Belgium.
The first day I announced an agenda. So this morning I'm going to change it a little. And I wanted to first read some of what you wrote and talk about that perhaps for half an hour. And then I'd like to chant around together. And then spend some time, the remainder of time, looking at some selections from this book, Bhakti Loka by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. The letter by Prabhupada and my commentary seem to really dig up a lot of thoughts and feelings in devotees, those topics about coming forward to accept service in the spiritual master and all of the sometimes heavy implications of that. First I'll read a couple of papers that don't raise questions but just express realizations, and it will help us refresh our minds on what the topics are. I also feel that these papers, they express responses pretty well of most of the devotees. Some of them, I'll mention who wrote them, and sometime I won't. This is by Mukunja Devadasi. This morning's presentation gave me a deeper understanding of service to the spiritual master. My initial response was fear of honesty, or honestly, looking at myself and my shortcomings on my side of the relationship. I started to question myself about my motive of serving you. Was it true love and care, or was it sentimental or even motivated? It made me think how I should be more careful of what I come forward to offer or do, again, not just through sentiment. It made me realize actually how unqualified and how small my capacity is to serve you, but at the same time, if I intelligently and honestly engage myself, knowing my capacity and where I am at, then it is still possible to please you. Dr. Mark, when you read about that one shouldn't promise anything to one's spiritual master what one is not sure that one will be able to do, I became a little bit afraid. Again, fear. We don't want to be afraid, but in some cases it's good to face our fears. What is it that, because there's something there that ought to come out and we ought to face it rather than always hide against some fear. So this facing of in such an important relationship, am I doing it rightly and so on. Face the fear. I became a little bit afraid because in one of my letters I told you that I would do a certain amount of work by a certain time. But since I had planned everything, considering my capacities and limits, I hope I shall not have to apologize before you for not having fulfilled this work. Still, it's got clear to me that before I take any responsibility, I should thoroughly think it over, whether I'll be able to manage it, lest I disappoint my spiritual master. Had I time, I would write more. Some of these papers, maybe I'll just respond to you in letter form if I don't read them. Okay, now here's ones that raise some questions. Here's a devotee began to raise questions about, remember I touched on how when we hear about Prabhupada in this context, or any context, but all devotees, even if they're not his direct disciples, are drawn to their direct relationship with Prabhupada. And it's a fact that many new devotees, they come first to the movement because of Prabhupada, and later they meet the initiating spiritual master. So it's something to work out, the shifts in understanding. Who is the spiritual master, and then Prabhupada's stature and the stature of your spiritual master. So this devotee is writing about that, and then asks the question, is there a difference between guru and guru patra? What is for you perfected guru, and who is a perfect disciple? Is it wrong to think that a spiritual master can still learn some things and change his opinion after seeing that some things did not go the way he was expecting them to go? So, rather than deal with each one of these, I would like to say that there's sort of like a group of questions asking, is my spiritual master pure devotee, when they ask. And that's a difficult question to come to a judgment about. In one sense, we shouldn't even be doing it. Or it can be answered on different levels as to what a pure devotee is, so it's difficult to ascertain and to judge. Same thing with being a perfect disciple. And even if you can do it, the prophet is questionable, assigning a certain lack of purity, a certain standard of purity or lack of purity, lack of perfection to the spiritual master, the disciple, involving so much judgment. But saying that there's some worth in that, I can think of an alternative approach, or another kind of question that seems even more important, which would be to discuss not the purity of the person, but ask yourself, what is the purity of my relationship with the person? This is something that, but right away, opens up more activity and practical action rather than speculation. You ask yourself, what is the purity of my relationship with my spiritual master? That's actually mostly what we were discussing. When I come forward to say something, am I sincere? And why do I want to come forward and doing something? Am I honest? And so always to try to keep that communication, the actual communication, whether it's by letters and speech, and the attitudes and examples between myself and my spiritual master, always keep that as pure as possible. This seems to be more our business than making ourselves a judge. High court judge. But I won't avoid this, the thrust of this question also, but I'm saying I think the other thing is more important endeavor. But Prabhupada says the perfection is that the devotee be always engaged in Krishna's service. Not that he can't make some mistake or can't change his opinion if things don't work out in a certain way, but that always he's engaged in Krishna's service. Even for Srila Prabhupada, things didn't always work out, and he changed his methods of spreading Krishna consciousness, changed his attitudes towards certain things. But he was always constant in thinking of Krishna and serving Krishna. As for the difference between guru and guru tattva means the whole group of gurus, that there is a certain people, just like there are elders, even in Krishna Lila, there are many different kinds of parents. But then there's Mother Yasoda, she's Krishna's mother in Vrindavan. She's Krishna's mother. But all the others are like mothers. And sometimes In the pastime of bewildering of Lord Brahma, Krishna gave all the mothers a chance to be his actual mother. But mostly Mother Yasoda is a mother, and they're like mothers. So, that's Vedic culture, even not only in Krishna Lila, but in the world, that one should see all women as mother. But still, there's a distinction between your own mother and motherly persons. And similarly, guru figures, persons who are like gurus to you, who are like guides to you, they're all gurus. And guru, where the persons you follow mostly, Diksha and Shiksha gurus. So in a sense there's no difference, but there has to be some difference, because how could you be listening equally to 100 different persons who might have strong different emphases and have different instructions. And say someone says you should go to India, no, you should go to France, and it would be impossible. You have to follow somebody. So you, out of Guru Tattva, you select predominant person. I think I've answered these questions. Is there a difference between Guru and Guru Tattva? What is a perfect Guru and who is a perfect disciple? And can the spiritual master still learn some things? I should hope so, that he should be able to keep learning some things. But you should have confidence that he already knows enough to guide you. Otherwise, why accept him as a spiritual master if you think he's not competent in learning? Any questions about these questions and answers? Another devotee wrote nicely. I thought Gopi Manjari got right to an important point. The quality of honesty. If you're honest with yourself, then you can be honest in relationship with the spiritual master. I indicated that too. We were talking about how these devotees came forward and said, I'll take on the Sanskrit department. Yes, I'll run a press for you, I'll do this. And then they couldn't deliver the goods. So we were saying that sometimes one shouldn't come forward for such intimate service until he works out some things for himself or herself. Otherwise you may create some awkward situation. So therefore the quality of honesty, if you want to be honest toward the spiritual master, you have to learn to be honest with yourself. If you're in the habit of deceiving yourself, you don't know who you are, you don't undergo any introspection, you'd be more likely to go forward with some false offer to the guru without realizing that you just said something you're not capable of, you just said something you're dishonest, that's dishonest. And so that's honesty is such an important thing. Here's one by Chaitanya Chandadaya. He's making some comments. How is it that by wrongly motivated service one may create a displeasure for the spiritual master? This question is close to the other question, why leaders of the spiritual movement falling down, even though they are expected to stay on the highest level of sadhana. I'm still facing a lack of understanding on this. All intellectual answers seem to lack a deepness of realization. It shows, in a sense, that my motivation is not free from tatista. This is the main block in my relationship with my spiritual man. It seems to me a trial. The fault is reality for my life. So, the big question here, one may take on service with different impure motives. One might be, we were talking about the one, like the child wants to be praised. So, another one, or related to that, would be a pride. So, we want to be, we have pride, we're not humble. So we want to be seen as a big devotee, and one way to do that would be to be seen as a very prominent disciple of our spiritual master. Then we can exert this anartha of pride. But you won't. You'll just be cheated yourself if that's your motivation in service. Different things may come to you by your hard endeavor. Although it's motivated by pride, you can still work very hard and you get good results. But then eventually that pride will cause you to fall down. I have a little problem with your English expression, but I think what you're saying is that in the history of ISKCON, the fact that these gurus have fallen remains a kind of enigma for you, that you don't understand. People have explained to you why it's happened, but you still never quite satisfied it. Yeah. So for me, it's this is definitely a traumatic event in my own life, because I'm so close to the whole thing, and I was close to those persons, and. It's by saying traumatic, I mean that I can't. Something is so emotional in you, you can't really deal with it. Something really close, like say, you know, like the death of your mother or father, or something, or some way that you really failed something in your life, that you just you give some answer as to why it happened, but you just kind of put it somewhere without really completely getting into it, and you just go on with your life, and you just can't deal with it because. Emotionally, you can't deal with it. Well, say something really unpleasant, like if someone suffered some sexual abuse when they were a child from some adult, they can consciously just like forget it. They don't remember that it happened. But at the same time, it's not like it was so unimportant, but it's just like deformed them and was so painful that they won't even allow themselves to think of it. That's like trauma. So. I'm just stating something very personal to you that I can't figure that out, and it's still like it's still something that like you're saying, it's just like a big why. Is there, why did it happen, or how did it happen? It's like saying, well, you know, how did it go wrong? What went wrong? How did everything go wrong? How did it go so wrong? And yes. There's explanations, and we got it together now, and everything is understood, but still one wonders what happened completely. It doesn't know. But I have a simple answer, having admitted that for me to answer this question, I'm not answering it like a religious scholar outside of ISKCON. I'm a wounded participant. But I do have an answer that seems simple and meaningful, and that is that if you leave an opening for Maya, just a little one even, she will enter and knock you down, whoever you are, whether you're Lord Brahma or spiritual master, a lot of followers and controlling big areas and Lakshmi and so forth. So we have to be very careful. Just the examples of Lord Brahma, sometimes does very wrong things, Lord Indra. And we ask, well, we even ask philosophically, how is this possible that such a devotee could act like that? And we're told that the answer is it's arranged by Krishna so that you can see, and unless you are very careful, if it happened to a big devotee, then it'll happen to you unless you're very careful. So don't let these different weeds form. But you have to be careful. A little mistake can grow and grow and grow, and then this is what can happen, no matter who you are. So, granted that that's a fact, then the next thing is that what to do after you fall. There's a lot of people may fall, and so it's important. It's not like it has to be the end that a person falls, and then he's so ashamed or just gets so entrapped by Maya and sense gratification that it's over for this lifetime. But that's another point, is that maybe we can't figure out, except in the simple way that I told you, why a devotee who seems to be very well placed falls down. But figure it out or not, what does that devotee do now, that ex-devotee? Surely it's possible, according to Krishna conscious Siddhanta, to come back. In fact, you don't even have to do any atonement. All you have to do is just start doing service again, and Krishna will forgive you. So we have to get up from our fall down, whoever we are. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. But a little maybe harder for someone who had so much influence, to be dishonored is worse than death. So it's very shameful to pick up from that position. Therefore, the devotees have to be compassionate. And mostly they are. Devotees in ISKCON are compassionate towards any fallen devotee who tries again, whoever that devotee may be, big or small. Because we're all sincere, we want devotees, we're working to bring new devotees. So if someone has fallen, we want to welcome them back, provided they are humble and they don't have a wrong motive. So as we extend that to others, we can extend it to ourselves if we fall down. But definitely we have to work to come back. This question that you say you're trying to figure out, it reminds me of, in literature, there's the concept of tragedy. Like it started with the Greeks, Greek tragedy, a theater, and then Shakespeare wrote tragedies. I remember, I think it was Greek tragedies in school studying, that one of the qualifications of a tragedy, like for the playwright, was it had to be, the tragic figure had to be in a position of great prominence, or like a king or something like that, so that his fall down would affect a lot of people. And then it was a true tragedy, that it couldn't be just an ordinary Shudra fall down. And that wouldn't constitute, at least in terms of this, a drama, a tragedy. And I think Shakespeare's histories are like that too. He writes about some great figure, and then in Greek tragedy, the big flaw, I remember even the word Hebrus, which means pride. And when somebody would have so many good qualities, but he would be proud, Hebrus particularly means to think yourself like the gods, or to be like God. And then for that one fault, then he would fall down, and there would be a tragedy. Of course, in more modern times, that idea has been replaced, and literature and stories and everything tell more about ordinary people's tragedies, how they try to be happy in life, and some, whatever it is, a tragedy happens in their life. Usually it ends in death, you know. But we don't have to think like that. That a person who's following the rules and regulations, if they come to fall down, that it's like a tragedy of death, it's over. Like bhakti is so liberal and over rejuvenating that it's not a tragedy. It's just an occurrence, a fall down on the road of bhakti, and you can get up again. Failure is the pillar of success. You can do even better. But certainly, anyway, I don't want to talk about that particular thing. But that's the analysis of it.
in Krishna conscious terms.
And this leads me to the last one I want to comment on, connected. I think this is very...